The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Hello and welcome to a podcast looking at the literature of crime and children, and also criminal children.
It is William's spirit of upbeat anarchy that distinguishes so many British crime stories from their tough guy American counterparts.
That was Len Dayton on The Dirty Rapscallion of a Boy with a Crooked Tie and a Grimy Collar, Just William. We'll be talking to Tana French and Sophie Hannah about the art of the psychological thriller, and we'll be name-checking a few of the crime favourites suggested by our Twitter followers. Julia Eccleshare, otherwise known as Children's Book Doctor, reveals the best summer reads for children, and we pop into Pop Up, a brand new festival of stories for children. What exactly is the crime thriller? Is there even such a thing? Is it just about clever plotting, or is there something more lurking underneath the floorboards of that pristine estate agent's computer demo of your average £1.2 million desres? I don't choose that metaphor idly because it's the setup of Sophie Hannah's latest novel, Lasting Damage. She's with me here in the studio today, along with a rising star of the genre, Tana French, who hit the floor running with her first novel, Into the Woods, in 2007. And whose most recent novel, Faithful Place, is just out in paperback. Welcome, both of you. I'd like to start by discussing what sort of books you actually write. Is there such a thing as a crime thriller, or is that sort of a hopelessly naive bit of taxonomy?
I think of crime as the sort of superset. So crime novels are the big category that include all the different subgenres. And I would say thriller is a subgenre within the overall crime category. I don't know whether you'd agree with that.
Yeah,
right?
I think definitely. I think also it's a genre that's being constantly redefined at the moment. People are pushing the boundaries and trying to create new subgenres and sub-subgenres. Like there's a fairly big explosion, more psychological crime that kind of crosses boundaries over into literary stuff. I mean, you write very psychological crime, very definitely.
They're not spy thrillers. So thriller also has its subgenres, doesn't it?
Yes. I mean, generally thriller is used in two contexts. One is the sort of action thriller, spy thriller, the sort of what I call the blokey thriller.
Tom Clancy,
explosions, submarines, CIA conspiracies. But people also talk about the psychological thriller, which is a very different thing. It's usually more of a sort of domestic setting. The motives usually have more to do with interpersonal relationships. People aren't often on the run from the CIA in psychological thrillers.
And I think the factors that make something a psychological thriller are very different. Like, if you hear just spy thriller, you expect a very fast pace and you expect, like, a lot of physical danger, whereas a psychological one, you don't necessarily expect things to belt along at quite such a pace, and you are expecting the jeopardy that the protagonists are in to be more psychological than physical.
OK, let's start with you, Tana. Your novels have been described as linked mysteries. Tell us about that.
Well, I figured the standard thing to do is to keep the same narrator and follow through a series where you follow that narrator through the ups and downs and, you know, through life. And I realised that I'm more interested in writing about the huge, big turning points in someone's life where, you know, everything changes, where their lives are never going to be the same. And you can't really do that with the same, following the same narrator from book to book, because there's only so many of these big turning points that any one person has in life. So the way I link the books is I'll pick up on a secondary character from one book and make that character the narrator in the next book and go on to describe their huge turning point in life, or, you know, the case, because they're usually detectives, the case that changes their whole lives.
Okay, so the protagonist of this novel is Frank,
who's a
dysfunctional sort of, domestically dysfunctional undercover detective working in Dublin. Tell us about him and his story.
Yeah, he showed up in The Likeness as Cassie's old undercover boss, this guy who, very much a Dublin guy and very much a guy who would do absolutely anything to himself or to anyone else to get his man. And now he's been dislocated from his family for a long time, for 22 years, and now he's being drawn back in. And so in a way, he's undercover within his own family, within his old neighbourhood, which is this very tight-knit inner-city community. And he's kind of at a point where he's being forced to decide whether he's a cop undercover in Faithful Place or whether he's a Dublin boy who's in a way been undercover in the police all along.
Mm-hmm. And of course there are relationships not only with his family and the people of his old neighbourhood, but also with his police colleagues who we've seen in other novels. Would you just read a little bit setting up a bit of both, actually. His relationship with Dublin, but also his relationship with Scorcher, who's...
Yeah, his friend, his rival, his nemesis. A bit of all of them. Scorcher said, "According to Matthew and Teresa Daly, you haven't been seen in the area since the night you and Rose flew the coop." I shrugged. "There's only so much local colour one man can take." Scorch drew a neat smiley face in the head of his pint. "So, nice to be back home, yeah? Even if this isn't the way you pictured it?" "If there's a silver lining here," I said, which I doubt, "that's not it." He gave me a pained look like I'd farted in church. "What you need to do," he explained to me, "is see this as a positive." I stared at him. "I'm serious. Take the negative, turn it around into a positive." He held up a beer mat and flipped it over to demonstrate the concept of turning something around. Normally, I would have communicated to him exactly what I thought of this batshit crazy advice, but I wanted something from him, so I kept a lid on it. "Enlighten me," I said. Scorcher demolished the smiley face in one long gulp and wagged a finger at me. "Perception," he said when he came up for air, "is everything. If you believe that this can work to your advantage, then it will. Do you follow me?" "Not really, no," I said. Scorcher gets meaningful on adrenaline, the way some guys get maudlin on gin. I wish I had ordered a short on the side. "It's all about belief. This country's entire success is built on belief. Is Dublin property really worth a grand per square foot? Is it? Fuck. But that's what it goes for, because people believe it is. You and me, Frank, we were ahead of the curve there. Back in the 80s, this whole country was in the shit. It hadn't a hope in hell, but we believed in ourselves, you and me. That's how we got where we are today." I said, "I got where I am today by being good at my job. And I'm hoping to Christ you did too, mate, because I'd like to see this one solved." Scorcher gave me a stare that was halfway to an arm wrestle. "I am very fucking good at my job," he told me. "Very, very fucking good. Do you know the overall solve rate for the murder squad? 72%. And do you know my personal solve rate?" He left a gap for me to shake my head. 86%, sonny. 80, read it and weep, 6. You got lucky when you got me today." I gave him a reluctantly impressed grin and a nod, letting him win. "I probably did, yeah." "Damn right you did." Point made, Scorch relaxed back on his bench, winced and shot an irritable glare at a busted spring. "Maybe," I said, holding my pint up to the light and squinting thoughtfully at it. "Maybe this was both of our lucky day."
Don't you just know there's going to be trouble ahead? And that's really interesting because it's so Dublin, isn't it? And it's not just them talking about the Dublin property market, but it's the whole language they use.
Yeah, this was very much a Dublin book in a lot of ways. This is one that's very much rooted in Dublin language, Dublin expressions, Dublin sense of humour. I'm hoping, and I think that translates, because it is a very specific and very dry and very creative sense of humour and not particularly... tasteful, maybe.
You're not totally Irish, are you?
No, I'm a mix. I'm a little bit of everything. I've lived in Dublin longer than anywhere else, though. I've lived there since I was 17, since I was a kid. So it's home more than anywhere else is. We moved around a lot when I was a kid. And I think this is the one place where I know my way around, know, you know, all the different, what every different accent means, where to get a good pint, where you don't go after dark. And I think that's the stuff that makes a place home or not home. But in a way, being a little bit of an outsider, I think, gives you a perspective that if I were a real, proper, born and bred dub, I wouldn't necessarily have.
Sophie, your locus, in a way, is the relationship between your detectives of your novels, isn't it?
Each book sort of furthers the relationship between the two central detectives, Simon and Charlie, and each book also has a heroine who is particular to that book, and her story is really the story that drives the book. So Simon and Charlie are main characters in the books, but they're not the only main characters. It's never entirely their story. Their story is sort of unfolding around the edges while they're trying to work out what's going on in the particular case that the book is about.
Will you just read a teeny little bit, which will just demonstrate their relationship to people who don't know it yet?
In Lasting Damage, Simon and Charlie are on their honeymoon. And this section I'm going to read, what's just happened before, is Charlie's lying next to the swimming pool, watching Simon, who is floating on the pool on a sort of inflatable Lilo thing. And she's basically wondering why he isn't doing anything. Why isn't he reading his book, which is Moby Dick? He's brought Moby Dick with him to read. And more importantly, why isn't he paying any attention to her, which is the problem she's had for 6 books now. Moby Dick was his favourite novel. He read it once a year. He brought it with him to Spain. It was supposed to be his honeymoon reading. So why wasn't he reading it? Why was he content to float aimlessly, as if there was nothing else he wanted to do? The leaves and petals on the pool's surface looked as if they were making more of an effort than he was. Why wasn't he having sex with his wife? Weren't you supposed to spend most of your honeymoon in bed? Or was that only if you hadn't slept together before the wedding? Charlie sighed. Was she expecting too much? After years of avoiding all physical contact with her, Simon had decided last year that it was time they consummated their relationship. Since then, everything had been fine. Well, fine-ish. Charlie still didn't dare make the first move. She sensed Simon wouldn't like it. It was equally clear that talking, during, immediately afterwards, or on the subject of, was forbidden. Or was Charlie imagining barriers that weren't there? Maybe Simon wanted nothing more than for her to say, "Do you like having sex with me, or do you only do it because you feel you have to?" Physically, it seemed to work for him, but he always seemed so removed, eyes closed, silent, almost robotic at times.
Now, I'm really interested by that passage because it could be from a totally different sort of novel, couldn't it? It could be from a relationship novel.
Yes, I mean, my crime novels are very, very, very psychological. So the way I get into the police characters, although obviously their day job is solving the case, I access them via their thoughts and feelings. And I think probably I go into their various dysfunctions and levels of screwed upness in slightly more depth than you might expect from a more traditional crime novel. But I mean, that's because, you know, I deliberately decided to write psychological thrillers. Psychology is my main interest in crime fiction. Mm-hmm. And so, I just want all the characters, including the police characters, to be fully rounded characters. And fully rounded characters in real life and in fiction have all these hang-ups that you don't get to see if you only look at the sort of surface stuff.
Now, Frank, of course, in yours, Tana, is also has got hang-ups, hasn't he? Leading from a life event that is part of the plot of this particular novel.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Back when he was 19, he and his first love, Rosie, they were planning to run away together, elope to London, start a whole life far away from their extremely dysfunctional families. But she didn't show up, and he figured that she had dumped him because his family was considerably more dysfunctional than hers, and she didn't want to get involved with any of that. But now her suitcase has shown up in the wall of a ruined house on the street, Faithful Place, where they grew up, and it looks like she didn't go anywhere at all. And so he's having to come to terms with the fact that the event around which he's shaped his entire life, the event that meant he cut himself off from his family, he became a detective, everything he's made of himself is based on something that isn't true. So the landmark around which the geography of his whole life is based has come tumbling down, and he's having to start over. And I think that's the thing about psychological thrillers, is that you always end up with fairly screwed up protagonists, because screwed up people are more interesting than people for whom everything is genuinely perfect. Like every now and then Sophie, you'll start with a character who looks like they've got absolutely everything in place and everything's perfect, and that's only so that we can watch the house of cards go tumbling down. Because, yeah, perfection is interesting for about a page.
But it's not just true of psychological thrillers, is it? I mean, you know, smiley Raymond Chandler's characters, they all have these flaws, don't they?
I think, yes. It's certainly, you know, standard and indeed expected for protagonists of crime novels of any kind to have flaws. I think it's the way the flaw is described and handled. So normally, while clear signals will be given to the reader about what the flaw might be, and you'll see the character behaving in their flawed way, there doesn't tend to be much really in-depth psychological pondering and analysis, I find. Anyway, I mean, certainly in sort of action thrillers, you see the dysfunction, you get a couple of lines about why it might be, and that's generally regarded as kind of enough. But actually, you know, most real people who have psychological problems need years of psychotherapy to even make any progress at all. And certainly Simon Waterhouse, my cop hero, falls into that category, which is why, you know, I mean, readers have been writing to me for 6 books now saying, when are you going to, A, tell us what his problem with sex is, and B, solve it? And I always write back very calmly and infuriating, saying, Well, you know, in a realistic time frame. And, you know, actually, really, if there were a real character who had Simon's particular problem, and I, of course, know what it is, tee-hee, you know, it would take ages. Finally, in book 7, the one I've just finished writing, an astute person comes up with a theory. I can't really go into too much detail. And Charlie hears this theory and knows that that's it.
The other thing about what you were saying with the psychological flaws is that I think in a really psychological thriller, they're very interwoven thematically with the book, with the main plot of the book. They're not just separate. It's not just that you have a detective who tends to get drunk all the time and is split up from his wife, and then there's the plot over here. It's that there's a strong thematic link between the main plot and the detective's particular dysfunction. Like, just for example, Lasting Damage, there's so much about control in there, in the main plot, about self-control, control of other people, the different ways in which people try to control themselves and their environment. And it's obvious even from that passage that you just read that control is a big issue in the relationship between your two main detectives, between Simon and Charlie. I mean, I'm trying to do the same thing anyway in Faithful Place. There's a lot about perception versus reality. What happens when what you believe in turns out not to be true? How much reality do you need in order to believe in something? And if you just keep on believing in something stubbornly enough, does it take on a form of reality of its own? And that's very true for Frank himself, and also within the plot. What's that relationship between belief and reality? And I think that's what kind of makes something a psychological thriller, is when the main character's psyche is thematically, I guess, very interwoven with the main plot.
One thing that I think is really interesting in your books so far is that the way you take a character who was minor in a previous novel, so Frank in The Likeness was there, but I didn't really, you know, he seemed definitely like a minor character who knew his place. Now then suddenly we meet him in Faithful Place and we realise that he's not a minor character in his mind. And I think that's actually one very realistic psychological detail about the way you write, is that the structure of your series embodies the truth that we are all main characters in our own life and minor characters in other people's lives. So, for example, Scorcher, who is hilarious as a kind of boastful, you know, I'm sneakily hoping he might be the main character of the next one so that we get to see him in the round.
Now, I'm going to play devil's advocate here and say, aren't you cheating? You're giving yourself all sorts of options, aren't you? You're not following the rigours.
But I don't think it's cheating. I think it's playing with the edges of the genre.
I would say for both of us, whatever we're doing psychologically, I can't see any way in which either of us isn't fully within the rules of the genre. That's one of the things I try to do, because I am a massive genre fan. I don't have any snobbery about crime fiction. I think it's the highest possible literary form when it's done well. So it's very important to me to stay firmly within the rules, as I see them, of crime fiction. And I do think, you know, one of the duties of the psychological thriller, because I think the phrase psychological thriller is bandied about all over the place, and often it's used just to mean a book where it's about interpersonal relationships, but that's not necessarily very psychological. But we're both fascinated by psychology, so we write really psychological thrillers. And I think one of the duties of the properly psychological thriller is to demonstrate that character is not this fixed thing that people seem to think it is. You know, someone can come along, act like a boastful idiot for a few minutes. In a conventional novel, that is signalling to the reader, this is a boastful character, here you are, you can sum him up in a few lines. Whereas I think in our writing, we're constantly encouraging people to think, or is he? Or has the person judging him judged him wrongly?
I'm coming from an acting background, so I'm very used to the idea of playing people who aren't me in any way. And the second you start writing in the first person, if you're not going to write a character who's based on you, you are writing someone who isn't you. To me, the big leap isn't whether you're writing a man or a woman. It's what kind of person you're writing. Like in The Woods, for example, the big leap wasn't writing Rob Ryan as a guy, it was writing him as somebody who's so badly damaged by this thing that happened to him when he's 12 that a whole chunk of his memory has been erased and his mind has been cracked straight across. Writing that kind of damage is the big leap rather than man-woman for me. And I think the big one is always writing a killer, because one hopes that most of crime writers haven't actually killed anybody yet. So that's, you know, that's the big leap. For me, it doesn't seem to be I don't particularly think about the gender gap in the writing.
Well, I'm sure lots of people will be going along with you, so thank you very much for coming in, and we look forward to the next instalments.
Thank you.
Well, we've got to that time of year again. Everybody's packing their bags and setting off on holiday, and Julia's just been saying that there was no traffic in London, so we think everybody's already gone. But for those of you who are still here, we've got lots of wonderful summer books lined up. With me in the studio is Julia Eccleshare, our children's books editor, but also Michelle Pawley, who runs the Guardian children's book site Reading Club. That's right, isn't it?
Yeah, Michelle? That's right.
That's connected with the Guardian Children's Fiction Prize, and one of our founder members, Luc, a.k.a. D'Artagnan, who's going to tell us how he's found the first few months on the site. Julia, will you start by just running us through some of the wonderful books that are coming up over the summer?
Well, I just chose books which I thought would be fun to read in the summer holidays, and they are... Partly I was very keen to look for some new authors because I've been very struck recently to discover how difficult it is for people to find new books because the bookshops typically stock only a really small range of titles. So I'm naming books which you may not find sitting on the shelf, but do go in and ask because booksellers will get them for you really fast. So it's always worth asking. But these are just enjoyable books because it seems to me that the one thing we don't talk enough about is how much fun reading can be. So there's nothing schooly about this. You can't be tested on them. They're just for pleasure. So the first one I chose was Stephen Butler's The Wrong Pong, Holiday Hullabaloo. Now, this is a sequel to the original Wrong Pong. Now, there is such a craze for these funny books. We have never, in all my time that I can think of, had so many funny books around. And such a sort of, that is what everybody wants to read. I mean, the 7 to 9 year olds, who are the ones, after all, we're most keen to get really engaged in reading, they just want to read a few, something that's funny. And this is a nice piece of knockabout humour, ideal for Horrid Henry or Jeremy Strong fans. Everybody behaves badly. The hero in the previous book went down the lavatory and found himself living with these trolls who lived in the underneath. And this time, oh my God, they've come back to disturb his suburban existence. It's full of jokes. It's quite good social commentary. And it's just a very entertaining read.
And he's sitting on the cover of the book. It's a rather a lovely bright cover. And he's sitting on the back of a green troll who looks a bit like a conker that hasn't yet fallen out of its shell.
He looks very like Fungus the Bogeyman, but with a smile on his face, because the whole point about this book is that everything turns out very well. There's nothing nasty in it. It is knockabout humour. Great, good stuff.
Okay, so what have you got next?
Well, next I chose The Donut Diaries, again in this mood of humour. The big seller of 2010 and 11 has been The Diary of the Wimpy Kid, which is an American import, but has been fantastically successful here as well and in film. And it really is one of those books, and I hate it when this happens, but it can be true. It is one of those books that I think is quite hard for adults to get. I think it just does go straight to the sort of 7 to 9 year old psyche. It's a very well observed view of the world from the kind of slightly diminished child position, but they're actually quite heroic. And in The Donut Diaries, they've done a very clever thing with these because they've already short-circuited to Andy Stanton's great success with the Mr. Gum books by using the same illustrator. So David Tasiman, who illustrates Mr. Gum, is here illustrating The Donut Diaries. So, you know, and Mr. Gum is hugely popular. I mean, for a funny book to be such a sort of currency is amazing. And I think The Donut Diaries will do it the same again. Dermot Milligan, whose diary it is, has a weight problem and is about to be sent off to Fatso Camp. It's such a wonderful name, Fatso Camp. I bet there are Fatso Camps all over the country, but I have not heard of them before. And so it's his observations about food, but it's really his observation about family, friends, and with his friends too, about fitting in and not fitting in. So it's just very good, ordinary, everyday currency, but in a very humorous way.
What sort of age?
Well, I think this is sort of 8, 9.
Now, your next one is Morris Gleitzman. We love Morris Gleitzman, don't we?
I love Morris Gleitzman. I think Morris Gleitzman is just a genius. He does something nobody else can do, which is he writes really amusingly about really difficult things. You know, he writes about problems, but they are never preachy or problem novels. And 2 Weeks with the Queen, which was his sort of groundbreaking book, is a story about cancer, essentially, and quite a lot of people, you know, including a boy whose mother dies of cancer. And yet, while it's going on, you are held by the humour as well as by the pathos. And I just think that's a very clever thing that he does. And he's just written this excellent trilogy about the Holocaust, which, again, was handling trying to tell the Holocaust in quite a humorous way, which is difficult. But In Too Small to Fail, it's a very modern tale because it's actually the story about a boy whose parents are really too rich to pay him any attention because they're investment bankers. So they are busy working and he is busy trying to sort of find his place in the world and particularly wanting a pet. Anyway, he meets up with an old childminder whose money has been lost by his parents and he now has to set about trying to get it back. And he has this scheme of getting his school friends to invest in him, which is just one of the sort of funniest set pieces I've read for a long time. Because the idea of a rather feeble kid at school who actually is hopeless at maths, convincing his friends that, and he sets out all these technical terms about bonds and yields and all of that, and they invest in him, and then he's meant to double their money, but he knows that he can't quite do it. It's a scam, but it's just a very clever idea. And of course, in the end, he, you know, does help out. And it's just a very wacky story, but with an absolutely true heart.
What have you got next?
Well, then I went back into time because I get so sad about authors who have sort of forgotten and I think are really outstanding. And this is just been reissued, so you might find it in a shop. And that's Anne Fine's Round Behind the Ice House. And in a sense, in the last 30 years, I think Anne Fine has been such a powerful influence on family stories. We think of Jacqueline Wilson being the person who writes about families, but Anne Fine's been doing it for years as well, and has started further back. And Round Behind the Ice House is just one of those incredibly sharply observed stories about friendship and how when a new person comes along it can distort the friendship. And so it's about, in this case, it's about twins who have a friendship with another person, but then she sets off into a different way of life and starts behaving differently and how it upsets the balance. And it's just beautifully observed, and she's a tremendous underwriter, so everything isn't fleshed out for you. You have to fill in some of the thinking yourself. So it's really a thoughtful piece of writing in a very classical form. But again, I think her observation would grip any child.
And that's for what sort of age?
Well, that's 10, 11, really.
I'm very surprised that she's neglected, because Mrs. Doubtfire is one of the great characters.
I know. And having been turned into a film, and, you know, a very, very successful film. But I think Anne Fine's books, and I don't actually think she's been done much favours by that cover, but Anne Fine is just, she just is such a quality observer of life. Mm. And she makes it clear that life is kind of full of complexities and difficulties, but she's very optimistic for children's role in it.
Next, I chose
a new author, Paula Rawsthorne, The Truth About Celia Frost, because it's such a great concept. The story is about this girl who, and you're totally spellbound from the beginning because she's apparently got some illness, which means that she can't do anything, that she might get a cut or a scratch or anything because she would bleed to death. And she believes all of that. And then something happens that shows that actually she doesn't bleed to death. She then sort of turns against her mother, who's the person who's been protecting her. But it then turns out that there's been a sort of scientific experiment and she was being treated as a lab rat and she's actually carrying some incredible virus. It's all a bit far-fetched, but it's nonetheless very gripping. It's the kind of story that once you start, it is a real, and I hate to use the expression, page turner.
And that's for teenagers?
No, that's for 10 to 12.
Okay. It's sort of thick, chunky book compared to the other ones.
It's thick and quite wordy, but a very quick read. Mm. And then I chose, just because I think they're really good stories, is How to Be a Boy, which is a kind of a bit of a giveaway title and could be really off-putting. I could just feel people's hearts sinking on holiday when their parents produce this book for them. But they're such good writers at the heart of this. So you've got Ian Beck and Jamila Gavin and Keith Gray and Mal Peet and Bally Rye, all looking at different ways of what being a boy is. And it's unapologetic because it says boys have been having a really hard time in the press. So, you know, this is a way of saying, actually, boys can be great too, and there are lots of different ways of being a boy. And it's short stories, which is also really good for holidays because you might not want to get stuck in a book for a long time, but it would give you a very good interlude. So I think that's a really beautiful collection, and don't be put off by the feeling that you're being given a message.
Mm-hmm. Now, none of these books, Michelle, feature on the Guardian Fiction yes. Prize because they haven't come out yet. They don't fall into our calendar year, I have to make that very clear. But we're now in the middle of running a series of book clubs, which will run throughout the summer, which is rounding up all the books that have been longlisted for this year's prize, aren't we?
That's right. There's been 8 books longlisted and we're featuring one book a week with a whole package of material around it. So we've got an interview with the author so you can find out more about how they wrote the book and what inspired it, all sorts of things about their background. We have a video from each author saying why you should review their book. It's not saying why their book should win the prize, it's why you should review it. And there's also an extract from each book so you can try before you buy or before you get it from your library. And the best thing is the books cover a whole range of ages, genres. There's funny books. We've got Andy Stanton, who Julia just mentioned, with Mr. Gum and the Secret Hideout. We've also got Lissa Evans with Small Change for Stuart, which is another hilarious book. They're for a younger age group, but it goes right up. There's Momentum by Sachi Lloyd, which is a real high-octane thriller of a book about energy crisis and free running and politics and the internet and augmented reality, all sorts of stuff in that book.
David Armand, who's one of my favourite ever writers.
And he's in with the brilliant My Name is Mina, which is the prequel to Skellig, which many people will have read, and is not just an amazing read, it's actually an amazing book to look at because it's got all different fonts and it's got empty pages and pages with all kinds of weird designs on. It's just a brilliant book. He's featuring on the book club this week, and we've got a lovely video of him saying why you should review his book.
Well, you have to obviously come to the Guardian Children's Books website. But someone who has already been there is Luke, who I introduced at the beginning of this. Luke, tell us a little bit about your involvement. You were one of our founder members. You've been with us now for the whole ride, about 4 months.
Yes, I'm Luke. I write as D'Artagnan. And as Claire said, I've been involved with the Children's Book website ever since it started. I've done lots of different things to get involved. Probably most notably, I introduced some poems read by Michael Rosen and Ted Hughes, which was quite enjoyable to do. But I would encourage anyone who hasn't already to get involved with the Children's Books website, because it offers an opportunity for children to extend their experience of reading beyond just the start to the finish of the book, and they can discover a whole new world of books where they can read reviews, find news, listen to podcasts, whatever. There's plenty of stuff to get involved with.
And you also wrote for us about your experience organising the Student Day of Action.
Yes, it's like a books community almost. So it's not just about books, but it's about children in general, what we get up to, but linking it back to books a lot of the time, which is nice.
Would you read a book called How to Be a Boy?
I'm not sure about that, really.
Tell us what you're reading, Luke. Go on, let's hear it.
I'm reading Understanding Power by Noam Chomsky at the moment.
This is our 14-year-old member, Luke, who we are very happy to have with us still. He's not quite graduated yet, but he will be graduating very shortly to the university. What brought you to the site, Luke?
Well, in November, there was an article on The Guardian's website asking for people to join the panel, because The Guardian were going to launch a children's book website on World Book Day in March. So I thought I'd get involved because I thought it would be quite an interesting experience.
Interestingly, we've got members all over the world. So we've got members in Canada, Peru, Egypt. We've got a very sort of vibrant community of members in India. And it's great because they send us postcards. They write postcards explaining, you know, what they're reading in their own countries and what kind of books are popular for kids in those countries, which is fascinating.
Julia, you sparked a very lively discussion the other day talking about books that don't stereotype people, that talk about diversity. And we've had contributions from all over the world about
that. Well, that's been absolutely brilliant, because typically, and what I was saying was that I was really talking about mainstream publishing. There's not been, we've been very, very slow to take up enough multicultural publishing, I think. And what's been wonderful is having all the input from the users of the site about what there is out there. And that makes a very useful resource for people who are looking for books.
And what's interesting about it is a lot of those contributors are adults. And so you think that the adults are reading our children's generated website and coming back with their own suggestions, whereas usually in journalism it's the other way around, isn't it?
Certainly, and it is a children-generated website. All the reviews on the site are written by children.
And then they do the interviewing as well of their favourite authors.
That's right. In fact, Luke, you came in really early on, I think even before the site had launched, and you interviewed somebody. Who is that?
I came in February here to the Guardian offices and interviewed Charlie Higson about his new book.
And since then we've had Jacqueline Wilson, Anthony Horowitz, David Walliams, Kathy Cassidy, and every time it's children interviewing the author, asking them their questions, however strange some of them may be.
So you can find those interviews, which are on video and audio, and also some of them are written through on guardian.co.uk/children's books. And sticking with children's books, Michelle has been out exploring London's newest festival for young readers. The first ever pop-up festival of stories took place a fortnight ago, and one of the star attractions was none other than Rasta Mouse.
Do you know what the festival this is? Pop-up! Can we say pop-up?
Pop-up.
Say pop-up.
Pop-up.
Iron Man.
Iron Man.
Iron Man.
Iron Man.
Pop-up time.
Pop-up time.
Oh, whoa.
I'm Philip Harder. I'm a children's author, and I also review books for the Guardian now and again. I'm here at the Pop-Up Festival on the Saturday. I've been doing a series of events. I've been talking about me being funny. I've been talking about Roald Dahl being funny. And at the end of my, I would say sellout, but everything's free. At the end of my full but free event, we had a beard making workshop with Catherine from the Book Trust. And I've seen some weird and wonderful people wandering around of all ages and all genders wearing sparkly beards.
There's lots of book festivals about at the moment. This is the first year of Pop-Up. Why did you decide to get involved in this one? What makes it different?
Oh, well, the great thing about it, if you look around here, you can see it's just families, and it's right in the heart of the local community. A lot of people today live locally, other people come from a bit further afield, but it's just a real mix, diverse backgrounds, cultures, and it's just a way of celebrating books in a really fun and different way. I mean, yes, we've got Moomin wandering around and Spot wandering around, but Michael Rosen's doing events with extraordinary people, and it's just, it's different, and it's fun, and really in at the deep end, in at the outset, making decisions as to what to build and who to have. So it's like getting your hand on the mechanism and being a part of it, but doing something rather different. And you can see it's a, well, no one else can see, but you can see it's a very, very fun and dynamic day. And tomorrow, I think, it's going to have a different feel again to it.
I am an Asian boy who is educated. I've got a virtual mind and it's simulated. I've got delegation and it's legislated. If you don't understand, I can get it translated. My lyrics are real, they're not annotated. So put it on your iPod, sync updated. I love music, it is never hated. And I love it so much, we should be related. The dream is to become intercontinental. I didn't say that accidental. Yes, I am sentimental and I got a background that's oriental. But let's just stick to the fundamentals. My scale is monumental. Who do you know that can flow like this and I sound so sick? I don't even have an instrumental. No other way, I am my own manager, enter my own world.
My name's Daniel Hahn and I'm one of the trustees of Pop-Up. This weekend we're celebrating the Pop-Up Festival, which is a public free festival in Coram's Fields about stories, children's books, words and pictures. And this is actually the culmination of a 5-week project working with local schools, working with local community groups to get people excited about stories, to get people excited about reading and storytelling.
I come from a golden generation that are living with opportunities their ancestors couldn't even dream of. I come from a generation that have lost the original rhythm and poetry. I come from the East End.
Today we have a lot of poets, the Roald Dahl Funny Prize. At this moment, Axel Scheffler is talking about Pip and Posy, just behind where you're standing. We have Catherine Johnson, who has a tent where she's recreated the tavern from Nest of Vipers.
This is my Nest of Vipers tent. It's a recreation of an 18th century inn, which is in my book called The Nest of Vipers, which is the haunt of a gang of confidence tricksters in 1712. So we've got a barman that sells you insults. You can get 18th century insults. We're doing story writing workshops. There's dressing up for kids, littlies, and story writing for older ones.
Even though it feels kind of enormous and ambitious and kind of terribly exciting, there's a really nice buzz here. But it is in fact only a pilot. It's only the first one we've done. So we're very keen to try and replicate this in different places and with different groups and with different partners, different organisations we can work with.
Michelle Pawley at London's Pop-Up Festival. And that's almost all we have time for this week. But Lindsay Irving is now joining me with news of the thrills and chills in store during the coming week.
Do look out for the Observer's Summer Reads for Children this weekend. There's lots of great suggestions there for filling the big empty summer holiday hours. Also, look out for our crime special in Saturday Review.
Len Dayton, who we quoted at the beginning, is one of the contributors to that. Others include Frederick Forsyth, Nikki French and Benjamin Black.
And we're hoping to put together a list of the crime fiction that you recommend that we read before we die, hopefully not gruesomely. So please do share your favourites with us. You can find that on guardian.co.uk/books.
We put out a call for suggestions to our Twitter followers earlier this week under the hashtag #TopCrime and got some excellent suggestions to be getting on with. Lindsay, which are your favourites there?
Well, Oldcastle Books said it's got to be No Beast So Fierce by Eddie Bunker, which is apparently based on his experience in San Quentin. Andrew Driver recommends a great early Elmore Leonard, which you might not have heard of, called Swag. And Simone Healy says any Simon Beckett, but Chemistry of Death in particular, beautifully gruesome and graphic in a technical way.
just in case you thought Guardian readers were softies. And last but not least, Guardian Weekend has a fantastic summer fiction issue coming out on Saturday with a lineup of short stories, including one from David Nichols, author of One Day. It's called Every Good Boy, and it has a line which is particularly appropriate, we thought, to the end of this podcast.
She reached across and carefully removed my hand from the keyboard, as if taking a knife from a psychopath.
So there's nothing left now but to thank everybody who's contributed to this podcast, including our Twitter followers. Thanks too to Tana French, Sophie Hanna, Julia Eccleshare, Lindsay Irving, and our very bloodthirsty producer, Ian Chambers, who's still giggling. I'm Claire Armistead. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.